Because of the two appeals, or at least the two different numbers, the cases are, it strikes me there's a lot of overlap in the two issues. You've been allotted 40 minutes. You don't have, you can combine the two arguments any way you want to in using your 40 minutes. You've been given 20 minutes, 40 minutes total. I don't want anybody up here for 40 minutes. But you can feel free to talk about one or two. The 20 minutes is yours to use how you wish.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
My name is Kimberly Murphy. I, along with co-counsel Lisa Campo, we represent the appellant, Adrian Peterson, in this matter. This is on appeal from two records, as the court noted before, 1178 and 2093. But there was a question raised by the court, delivered to us by email, I believe, last week, and I'd like to probably be a good idea to start that with that one. So the question was, what was the impact of the July 6th 2015 suspending order, and was the subsequent order of July 17th, 2015, did that effectively lift the suspension? It's our contention that the July 17th order did, in fact, lift the suspending order.
And the court's concern is this, and there's not a lot of guidance from the Supreme Court on this particular issue, but on all of the cases talking about whether the court has successfully suspended the running of the 21 days, it's that the court has to be very, very specific and has to use the magic language in Rule 1-1, suspend, vacate, modify. And to suspend or to stop the running of the 21 days, you have to be that specific. And so the question is to essentially reverse your very specific stopping. Do you need something more? And the scenario that came to mind was, if you had set it for hearing, you had gone to the hearing, something had come up, and the court had entered an order continuing the hearing for another 20 days, that would be a further order of the court, but I assume all the parties would say that wouldn't have lifted the suspension.
Correct. There's a couple of things I'd like to direct the court's attention to, just so that, because I believe that the further order of court did, in fact, take the July 17th, 2015 order. For starters, the wording of the order says it comes before the court upon plaintiff's motion for reconsideration. So the introductory paragraph actually speaks to this is the subject matter. This is the basis for the suspending order being entered. It also says that it's suspended pending further order of court. Now, in the Supreme Court of Virginia, I will grant that this is dicta, but in Super Fresh Food Markets of Virginia versus Ruffin, which is 263 Virginia 555, it's the concluding sentence of the decision. It says, finally, we also stress that a judgment which has been properly vacated or suspended under Rule 1:1 does not become a final judgment thereafter without a subsequent order confirming it as originally entered or as modified. The July 17th, 2015 order that was entered said the motion for reconsideration is denied. So, in effect, that is what basically lifted the suspension, because under the Superfresh guidance from the Supreme Court of Virginia, our argument is that that effectively pulled the suspension up.
I assume you concede a better practice would have been to reference the other order, and you understand that we're not just being technical here, because this goes to whether we can hear the case or not.
Oh no, it goes to jurisdiction. I understand where it goes, and I would agree that there should have been better language in the order, and there should have been better language not only in the order that decided the motion for reconsideration, but it could have also been more specific as to the suspending order. In other jurisdictions, other states, there are rules as to suspending orders. Suspending orders should have a specific time limit or should have these parameters. We don't, unfortunately, have that. I would submit that for this particular case, if the suspending order did not reference the motion for reconsideration, if it didn't reference it at all, then that order on July 17th, I don't believe, would have been sufficient to lift the suspension, and we would still be in limbo today.
Okay. Well, I think I fully understand you on that, and I'm confident that both parties really want us to find that we're properly here.
I believe so.
I've taken up enough of your time with the jurisdictional thing, unless either of my colleagues has a question. please get to the merits.
I have one quick question, and that is the additional page in the appendix that was missing that was submitted. The very last sentence on that is the court saying, therefore, the motion to reconsider is denied. The order of June 30th remains in full force and effect. So you get one on one page and one on a page that was there. I assume that's part of your answer.
Yes, Your Honor. That further elaborates on what the decision. I understand that circuit courts.
Intended.
Yes, because circuit courts do speak through their written orders, and the written orders before the court do just have the motion for reconsideration is denied. But yes, that additional piece of it does give extra evidence towards the intent of the circuit court at the time of the entry of the order. One of the first issues that Ms. Peterson has raised in her appeal is that the trial court erred in not ordering that she would be named as the designated beneficiary of Mr. Peterson's military survivor benefit plan. Now, there are not that many cases directly on point. This is a very difficult case because you have a profoundly incapacitated person on one side, and then you have a spouse who is struggling to support the children both emotionally and financially through this entire situation. But there was a case cited by the appellee, Jordan versus Jordan. It was unpublished by this court, but it talked about why it was acceptable, why the decision by the trial court was appropriate in failing to provide for survivor benefits for that wife. And in that case, no evidence had been presented either through examination of the husband or by the wife as to the survivor benefit plan. In this case, there actually was evidence. There was evidence put through the conservator. The conservator actually spoke about the survivor benefit plan, actually talked about the annuity payment being taken out of the military retirement pension. It was, and actually the pay stub with the information was also admitted to evidence. I believe it was defense exhibit number 13.
So that demonstrates that the choice had been made at one point, and there's some back and forth in the brief on whether he was required once he elected certain benefits for his spouse so long as they were married, and then you get to the question of whether you can, once you cease being married, can you discontinue that. It struck me that you cited a lot of authority, both federal law, both state law, both our cases, that stressed that the court had the power to do this. And I don't think the other side is contesting that the court had the power to order him to continue her on the benefit plan. But the question is, just because the court has the power to do something doesn't mean it was required to do something. It's not even a question of should, it's whether it was required to do so under the facts of this case. Do you have anything that points to that it was required rather than just being a power that the court had but elected not to use?
Well, the court didn't actually go down that road of whether it was required versus whether it was discretionary.
Well, but I'm asking
in decision.
You.
I think that in a circumstance like this, the problem is there's an incapacitated adult whose opinion on the matter cannot be made.
But you cite the guardianship mm-hmm. and conservatorship statute for that purpose, and I agree with you. He's no longer allowed, if he becomes sentient without further order of the court, he can't do anything about it. But our whole system and the reason that statute exists is so there are not two people making that decision, because we've said that the conservator stands in his shoes. So if it is permissible for the court to leave it with the retired military spouse, the choice, if that was a permissible decision, why isn't it enough to say the person who stands in his shoes gets to make the decision?
Because the court didn't say that the person who stands in his shoes could make that decision.
Well, except when he says him, necessarily, given the conservatorship, doesn't he have to mean the conservator?
Not necessarily, because there are certain cases in incapacitated adults where the opinion of the incapacitated person is actually supposed to be, under statute, taken into account when making decisions. That's actually written into the code for both guardians and conservators.
But if I understand your argument, the reason the circuit court erred is there was no way to take his current view into consideration because he's not capable of expressing it.
Yes, that is correct. And based upon what the trial judge said was he could elect to make the change or could elect to do it at any point. He physically couldn't. He made that election 18 days before his aneurysm burst. And I understand that there is a back and forth as to, well, was he required to or not required to? You're not required to make the SBP election to begin with.
But if you elect to go into that plan, you, short of a written notice from the spouse who would not be entitled to take, you have to include the spouse.
You have to include the spouse.
And once the divorce was final, he could elect to do some of the same things with his retirement plan, but he would not have to include her, correct?
Yes.
And so at the time he made a retirement plan election, if he made the election, he was required to list her.
He was required to list her at that time. I think the problem here is you have a situation where you can't consult with the incapacitated person at all. There's no way to understand what he would or wouldn't do if he was sentient or if he was capable of making a decision.
But isn't, as difficult as the task is, isn't that the conservator's job? I mean, he may guess, and guess is probably the wrong word. He may look at everything. He's going to make the best determination he can. And by the way, is there any evidence that he plans to discontinue her or in any way harm the children's interests? Because it seems to me there's a lot of good evidence on the record that the father did care about the children, and therefore it would strike me that the conservator would be required to look out at least for the children's interest.
Yes, there was no evidence at that time, at the time of these hearings, that the conservator would do that. The problem is that the statute requires that he act in the best interest of the ward, that the best interest of all these other folks, the dependents, the ex-spouse, any of that, that's not relevant to what the conservator does.
So but isn't the welfare of the ward's children in the best interest of the ward?
Arguably so, yes. But I guess the question is how much discretion do you vest in the conservator when that particular power is not statutorily given?
But once someone is essentially legally incompetent, the whole point of having a conservator or an attorney in fact or whoever, a guardian, is for that person to act in that person's stead because they can't act. So if we say they can't do this, aren't we saying they don't have full legal rights to represent the person they're supposed to be able to act instead of?
I don't think it says that they're not to act. The court gives, in a guardian and conservator case, the court gives, can enhance the powers, can restrict the powers of the guardian or conservator acting in that person's best interest. They could say, look, it is in the best interest to provide for the dependents, therefore we are going to order you to do X. They serve at the appointment by the court. The court retains supervision of them under court order. There's continuing jurisdiction over them.
But the conservator was not appointed for this case. The conservator has a general appointment. Is that correct?
Yes, the conservator has a general appointment. And part of the issue was when this whole thing came about, according to the record, when the final decree of divorce was actually being discussed between, and this was at the motion for, it was at the entry of the final decree of divorce. The problem was when they wanted to put in there that the SBP would be continued, the conservator's counsel didn't want to add that into the order. That's what raised this whole thing to begin with, because why wouldn't you want to continue it for the benefit of the children if, or for the benefit of the dependents, if that was not going to be an issue later on where they could say, nope, we're not going to make the election?
Isn't there a difference from continuing it for the benefit of the children and continuing it for the benefit of the spouse? Aren't those things different?
They are. However, when the children are minor and they're dependent upon a mother who is the sole source of their financial support, absent the child support, which was guideline, she's it for them.
If the husband was not incapacitated, would it have, what is there any law it would have violated for the trial judge to say, I'm going to leave it to the husband's discretion as to whether he wants to do this or not?
No.
So the only question is, only question for that assignment of error is, does the answer change because a conservator is in his shoes?
Correct. Okay. It's the incapacity. One of the other issues that was raised was that the trial court abused its discretion in awarding Ms. Peterson only 45% of the marital share of Mr. Peterson's pension when the evidence didn't support that award. All of the factors under the equitable distribution statute of 2107.3, there's a number of them. And the court went through all of those factors, and with all the other assets and liabilities, the only asset for which there was a disproportionate or less than 50% share granted to the wife was as to the retirement.
As to the wife, but that's not the only one that was treated disproportionately, correct?
I believe that was the only one.
At the IRAs that were found to constitute marital property, there was one in his name for $32,000. There were two in her name for $52,000 for him and $78,000 for her. They were found to constitute marital property. The trial judge left them with the spouse in whose name they were, even though they were marital property. That's a 60-40 split in her favor.
Yes, and that was by agreement of the parties as when they were going through the Bader sheets and they were making their agreements.
But that is a split of marital property that's not 50-50. It's just one that goes in your favor.
Yes, it does.
How about unreimbursed medical expenses? Isn't that a 92-8 split?
That was a 92-8 split,
in your client's favor?
Yes.
Is there any problem with those two?
No, because at that time, he had the higher income value. That's why there was a 92-8 split.
And she has the higher income now.
We're not here with that. We're not here on that evidence or the her
well,
job.
She testified that effective June 1st, she was going to be making $116,000 a year.
Yes.
And so, granted, it wasn't June 1st then, and I'm not asking you to supplement the record and tell me was her testimony accurate, but the trial court certainly could have taken her testimony that was pretty definite that she would be making over $100,000 a year going forward into consideration when it was considering the 11 factors.
Yes. It could. The problem is when you're talking about the retirement, that's supposed to go on for a very long period of time. And for her to have gotten less, she's there trying to raise the kids. She's the sole source of support. But more importantly, when the trial court looked at all of the evidence, it said that she had a negative impact on his career, but there's no link between the things that they said were unsupportive or that witnesses said she wasn't a good military wife and the actual negative impact on the career.
And there was evidence to this effect, so I don't think it's just that I grew up around military bases. The fact that the family and the only member of the family that could have said we're not moving, because minor kids can't stop you from moving, we're not moving, therefore you can't take the wing commander position, that's generally, and there was testimony to this effect, that if you turn down a promotion to a wing commander position, you're essentially you've terminated your career. You're not going to be promoted again.
But that evidence actually has to be presented. It can't just be speculation or.
Well, there was testimony. There was testimony that it was potentially terminal to his career. There's no question about that, right?
Potentially, yes, was
okay.
The word used.
And there was testimony that he couldn't accept it because of a decision of the family. And as I've said, I think the only reasonable inference to be drawn from a family decision, aka not his, given the minor children don't actually have a veto, is that it was her decision.
There was also testimony that went unrebutted about his injuries and whether or not he was grounded. And within the Veteran Administration's the determination of disability,
But we're not here with looking at pieces of evidence that might help you. We're here looking at a record with findings below where all the inferences flow their way, right?
But there was no causal link. You can't just say, well, that would have had a negative impact on his career. You had to have someone testify before the court that the reason why he had to retire as an 06 colonel is because he did not take this command. Nobody testified to that. You can't just say, well, we think that's what happened, or that's potentially what happened, or that's what could have happened, because that's speculative and highly prejudicial. It has to be, you have to have a link between the two. You can't just put on some evidence and say, well, it kind of points to it. There has to be something there. Someone who says potentially is not.
If evidence is required to that level of precision, don't you have to have a witness that says that he would not have changed the spousal benefit form? I mean, you're inferring it from something that happened in the past and extrapolating forward. Why can't they do that with the evidence that's favorable to them?
The evidence was that he didn't change the SBP form.
In the 18 days that it existed, that's
yes.
right, when he was not legally able to remove her.
But he could have told somebody. He was talking about all these other things, and all these other statements came in, and he could have made a statement where, you know, I have no intention of continuing her later.
You are well into your rebuttal time,
yes.
and we have taken a lot of your time, and you spent a lot of time on the jurisdictional question, so I'm going to give you some extra time, assuming that your opponent agrees with you on the jurisdictional question. We'll give you some of the time that she would have said, telling us that was a cogent thing to say and that we have jurisdiction. Counsel?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Melanie Hubbard on behalf of the appellee, Sean Peterson.
To cut to the chase, do you agree with what they said about we have jurisdiction?
I do, Your Honor. And just to bolster that, the position they took, and I believe it would be included in the record, it's not included in the appendix, is that subsequent to the July 17, 2015 order, on or about October 7, 2015, wife filed a motion for modification of the final order of divorce. And I don't believe that has been previously referenced. And the court's order on that was entered on October 23, 2015. And in that order, the court specifically states that it appearing to the court that motion for modification is beyond the 21-day period of Rule 1:1 and therefore is denied. So in that order, which was on October 23, 2015, the court made very clear, and the court speaks through its orders, that in fact the June 30, 2015 order was a final order.
It's another piece of evidence as to what the trial court intended, although the order, the motion, the denial of the motion for reconsideration order doesn't expressly state that.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's correct. So I am in agreement that the July 17, 2015 order lifted the suspension and the court's subsequent order and the actions of the court, also with entering the qualifying court orders and the retirement benefits court order with respect to the thrift savings plan, which is also not in the appendix, or further evidence that the court in those orders referenced the final order of divorce as having been entered on June 30th, 2015. And therefore, that was a final order that was no longer suspended.
And that October 23rd, 2015 order is in the record.
I believe it would be in the record, Your Honor. It's not in the appendix.
Thank you.
Your Honors, on appeal to this court, the evidence must be viewed in the light most favorable to the prevailing party below. And here that is the appellee. And all inferences must be granted to his benefit. It was not error for the trial court to decline to order the husband to maintain wife as a beneficiary of his military survivor benefit plan. Virginia Code Section 20107.3G2 specifically states that the court may order a party to designate a spouse or former spouse as the irrevocable beneficiary during the lifetime of the beneficiary of all or a portion of any survivor benefit or annuity plan. It is not mandatory. And in this case, the wife did not ask for it at trial. There was no evidence presented on that issue at trial. It was not stipulated to. Wife simply failed to meet her burden of proof on the issue. During the hearing regarding entry of the final order of divorce on May 15, 2015, the trial court stated it was not addressed, it was not requested, the court did not contemplate ordering that. That is a choice of the retiree, and that's what I ordered, and that should remain in place. On appeal, wife is focusing on the word choice in light of husband's disability. However, the bottom line is that the trial court declined to order that she be named as a beneficiary and left open to the husband or the conservator the option of designating the children. Again, the trial judge made clear in his ruling on wife's motion for reconsideration on July 17, 2015.
If at some point the conservator does remove the wife but doesn't name the children, would the wife or the child have an action against the conservator at that point?
Potentially, yes, if they feel that the conservator did not act in his capacity to fulfill the best interests of the ward, in this case, Mr. Peterson, Sean Peterson. So I do believe, Your Honor, if that were to occur in the future, potentially there would be an action with respect to the conservator's fulfillment of his role.
So I'd just like to follow up on that briefly, Dick. So you're saying you disagree with opposing counsel that the conservator's job or responsibility is only to look out for Mr. Peterson here, the person who's now incompetent for whom he's responsible, but also for his minor children?
I believe so, Your Honor, because it flows naturally from looking out for a parent's best interest that you also look out for the people who it was his role to look out for their best interests. So it trickles down to the children in this case. And if the conservator and all other evidence points to the fact that, yes, this was a father who was concerned about his children, and the trial judge recognized that on several occasions, that there are minor children involved here. The judge declined to order that the husband maintain the wife as the beneficiary and left open to the husband, ergo his conservator, to provide these survivor benefits to the children. And with respect to the wife's...
If the conservator doesn't have the ability to make the change, then it stays with the wife and doesn't go to the children. I mean, she may use the money for that purpose, but there would be no requirement that she use the military pension for the children's benefit, correct?
Your Honor, in this case, there was a spousal beneficiary election, and that occurred while the parties were separated but still married, which would have required the wife to consent to removal of her if he, in fact, elected her to be the beneficiary, elected the survivor benefits. However, once they become divorced, then that no longer applies, and there would have to have been an affirmative re-election of the wife for that to continue. So in those circumstances...
If the conservator does nothing now that they are divorced, what happens?
If the conservator were to have done nothing, then presumably there would be no survivor benefits in that case, because there does have to be an affirmative election. I am not clear on the law with respect to that issue, and it may be that there has to be an election of the survivor benefits, and it's up to the retiree to determine who receives those benefits. But, Your Honor, that goes to my next point, which is that had this issue been raised to the trial court, there would have been argument on this issue. There would have been argument as to what the role of the conservator was, what would happen if the conservator failed to elect a beneficiary, if the conservator did not continue the spousal beneficiary into a former spousal beneficiary election. All those things would have been put before the trial judge and would have given the husband the opportunity to present evidence as to what he would have chosen to do and what was the appropriate remedy in light of his incapacity.
If he had wished to participate in a survivor benefit plan that would allow somebody other than his wife to be the beneficiary, presumably the children, he would have had to make the election when he separated from the service to participate in the plan, correct?
Yes.
And so at that time, if he wanted to do that for the benefit of the children pending his divorce, he had to name her.
She would have had to have consented to him naming anyone other than her.
Right.
Yes, Your Honor.
But if he wanted to, if his plan was at some time in the future to name the children, he had to make the election then, wait for the divorce to be final, then he could make the change.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes, exactly. He could not change it in the interim. The divorce would have had to have been final. And, Your Honor, going back to the wife's burden of proof in the trial court, this court has stated in Bowers versus Bowers that when the party with the burden of proof on an issue fails for lack of proof, he cannot prevail on that question. And the court went on to state, furthermore, reviewing courts cannot continue to reverse and remand equitable distribution cases where the parties have had adequate opportunity to introduce evidence but have failed to do so. Parties should not be allowed to benefit on review for their failure to introduce evidence at trial. And that's exactly what happened here, Your Honor. If they were to be given the opportunity to reopen this case, that would give them benefit of having failed to bring this issue to the court's attention and to have presented adequate evidence on it.
Is the fact that they didn't wait until we were on appeal but actually raised it in the trial court, does that change the analysis at all? I mean, the matter was clearly still within the, given our discussion about the 21-day rule, they raised it when it was still within the breast of the trial court. Now, it was up to him whether he wanted to allow them, it may have been up to him whether to allow evidence, but it's not like they waited and raised it for the first time on appeal. They raised it when the trial court could still have acted on it, correct?
Right, but after the trial was concluded and there had been no evidence presented on that issue. And in that way, this case is similar to McGinnis versus McGinnis, which is a published opinion from this court from 2006, which involved a 32-year marriage. And in that case, the wife failed to present evidence related to the CSRS survivor annuity benefit. No evidence as to his costs, how the costs were to be paid, or any details on when that annuity would be paid to wife. This court found no abuse of discretion, the court's failure to award the CSRS survivor annuity benefit to wife. Likewise, in Jordan versus Jordan, and that's unpublished from 2004 from this court, the wife failed to present evidence about the details of husband's survivor benefit plan, and this court held that there was no abuse of discretion in the trial court's refusal to award wife survivor benefits. It was wife's burden of proof to put on that evidence at trial, and she failed to do so. And by failing to do so, and raising this issue on appeal, she would therefore prejudice husband, who did not have the opportunity to present his own evidence in light of the fact that the wife didn't raise the issue at trial. It wasn't raised in an opening statement. There was no cross-examination of the conservator on this issue.
The argument that we heard was there was no evidence offered that he said to somebody, I'm going to remove her as soon as I can. And I guess your response, therefore, is if somebody had raised it, we might have been able to put on such evidence.
Absolutely, Your Honor. The trial court asked counsel twice whether there was anything else to address before the court recessed at the conclusion of evidence. Wife's counsel responded no. During its ruling, the trial court asked counsel four separate times whether there was anything else to be addressed or clarified. Again, wife's counsel did not raise the issue of husband's SVP. With respect to wife being maintained as a beneficiary of husband's life insurance policy, Virginia Code Section 2107.3G2 specifically excludes life insurance policies. It says, but not to include a life insurance policy. The court had no jurisdiction to order that wife be maintained as the beneficiary of husband's life insurance policy. And again, there are cases directly on point from this court. Lewis versus Lewis, and that's a 2009 published opinion. And that states that under Code Section 2107.3G2, a trial court cannot order that a person obtain life insurance on himself for the benefit of the former spouse.
I think in Lewis versus Lewis, which I think was my opinion, if I remember right, there it was being implemented for the first, it was being ordered for the first time. Here is a question of it being maintained.
Yes, Your Honor.
The court ordering that it be maintained. Is that a difference? Or does the statute cover that as well?
The statute covers that, Your Honor, because I believe the statute covers policies, plans, annuities that are in existence. And in this case, the life insurance policy was in existence, and the statute specifically excludes life insurance policies from the court's authority to make any award with respect to the beneficiary for the wife.
Whether maintained or new.
Yes, Your Honor. And Lewis just clarifies that it's not just maintained, it's also new policies. And also in Moore versus Moore, which is an unpublished opinion, but it's from this court from 2011, there the court says, in the absence of a written agreement, the trial court was simply without authority to order husband to maintain wife as a beneficiary of his life insurance policy. And that clarifies, again, that the court has no authority to make that designation. The court does have authority to order a party, either parent, to designate the children as a beneficiary of all or a portion of a life insurance policy. But here the wife never asked for that. Again, this was a failure of evidence on the part of the wife at trial. She didn't ask for it. And in fact, any time any issues with respect to the children were raised, the wife's counsel objected, saying that there's been a custody trial. It's not appropriate for this matter, for this evidence to be raised at this point in time, as that matter has already been concluded. Now, the court heard no evidence with respect to naming the children as beneficiaries. At trial, wife sought only guideline child support. That was what she said in opening statement. That's what was said throughout. At no time did she ask for anything other than guideline child support. And had the wife been asking for the children to be maintained as the beneficiary of the husband's life insurance policy, that would have been included in the child support analysis. Potentially, there would have been a deviation from child support. There were other considerations that would have factored in had she made that known to the court that that was something she was asking for. She never asked for it. And even in the court's supplemental ruling with respect to child support, in which he denied the wife's request to be named on the life insurance policy of the husband, it specifies that she requested that she be named, not that the children be named. So again, The wife failed to present any evidence or make that request to the trial court. She only asked that she be maintained as a beneficiary of the life insurance policy, and there was no authority for the court to do that. With respect to the trial court awarding wife 45% of the marital share of husband's pension, in Papuchis versus Papuchis, this court declined to adopt a rebuttable presumption favoring equal division of marital property, and that remains Virginia law today.
Of the total marital estate, including the IRAs, which apparently were distributed in her favor by agreement, did she get 50% or pretty close to it once you factor everything together?
I wasn't trial counsel, so I didn't do the calculation, but I believe she may even have received more than 50%.
I try to avoid doing math when I can. But it strikes me that if only one factor was less than 50%, then by definition, everything has to be close to 50%. And then there was the IRAs that she got 60%, that she may have actually gotten more than 50% of the marital estate, depending how many retirement payments they are going out.
She may very well have, Your Honor. And again, it's not error to not order 50% on every asset. The court is required only to consider all the factors of 2107.3, which the court did in this case. And the court specified in his ruling that he had done so. And if anybody had any question with respect to any weight that he gave, any evidence with respect to any factor, they were to ask him. He gave both counsel the opportunity to do that on numerous occasions. And wife's counsel never asked with respect to any of the factors how much weight was given to any evidence. The trial court fulfilled its obligation to consider all the factors. And while there's a lot of focus on whether or not the wife's actions had a detriment to the husband's career, there was ample evidence that it did.
Well, even if we set all of that aside, isn't the profound difference in their current medical conditions and the evidence regarding their earning capacities going forward, wouldn't that provide a sufficient basis for this small deviation from 50-50?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And the court even said, after referencing the actions of the wife with respect to the husband's military career, the court said, and the husband's present medical condition is something that the court can consider. And the court did, in fact, consider that. He was in a dire situation.
The court was required to consider it.
The court was required to consider it, and the court fulfilled its obligation to do so. And on appeal, wife focuses on husband's disability with other assignments of error to try to support her case, but then fully ignores it with respect to that particular issue. That the court could have considered that issue alone with respect to his military retired pay, and ordered 45% goes to wife, 55% to husband, in light of the fact that he was in such a dire medical situation, no capacity to earn in the future, whereas wife had full capacity to earn, and in fact would be starting to work full-time again shortly thereafter.
And as far as, I know you can only go within the record, because we can only consider the record on appeal, but his medical condition, at least as far as we can note from the record, is largely unchanged. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. There have been some improvements, but he is still incapacitated. However, I've been informed that he has the ability now to respond to questions.
But he's still subject to the conservatorship order.
He is, Your Honor. Although now his mother and brother are the conservators. And, Your Honor, just to point to a case to support the 45% and 55% of the military retired pay is White versus White, again, another published opinion from 2010, in which the husband was 75 years old, suffered from Parkinson's disease, and was in an assisted living facility, whereas the wife was 25 years younger. And the court affirmed the award to husband of 55% of the entire marital estate in that case. And just touching briefly on the qualifying court orders, I just wanted to point out what I believe is an error in the interpretation of the language that's included in the actual qualifying court orders. And on appeal, wife's counsel seems to be mistaking the language to be months of creditable military service, which would pertain to an active duty member's retirement, as opposed to creditable service points, which is a language that is in fact included in the qualifying court order with respect to wife's military retirement. And that language is acceptable to DFAS. And wife relies on Sylvester versus Sylvester, in which the court entered a quadro correcting the erroneous math that was included in the final order of divorce in that case. And footnote 3 of the Sylvester case states the marital share is defined as the following fraction: number of creditable service points earned during the marriage to the party's date of separation, and then divided by the total number of creditable service points earned at retirement. And that case pertained to a reservist retirement plan, which is exactly what it is here. And the court used the exact language in that case, correcting the final order of divorce.
Is there anything in the record other than counsel's assertion that DFAS has any problem with the language in the quadro?
No.
Any testimony from somebody that they will have a problem?
No, Your Honor. And for that reason, it's speculative, and therefore that issue should not even be considered on appeal. And certainly those qualifying court orders should be affirmed and should be submitted to the plan administrator. And with respect, lastly, to any question with respect to indemnifying language included in the qualifying court order, that was not asked for. Again, this is not something that the trial court is responsible for doing sua sponte, to enter into a clarifying order. It was not specifically asked for by wife. The only time she asked for something that doesn't even include indemnifying language was 21 days following the October 23rd, 2015 qualifying court orders, and at that point it was too late. So she failed to present that issue to the trial court, and therefore she cannot present it for the first time on appeal. And for those reasons, Your Honors, we request that the trial court's orders be affirmed, and to the extent there is a remand, that it be done so on the basis of attorney's fees, in light of the fact that none of the arguments on appeal are supported by the case law from this court as the statutes. Thank you.
Counsel? As I noted when you sat down, although you only have 32 seconds on the clock, you took about 4 minutes addressing the jurisdiction question. I'm happy to allow you to use those 4 minutes for merits stuff if you'd like.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think we're just going to go briefly through. The issue with the quadros really comes down to they are considered final orders, and the reserve points, the formula is wrong on its face in the sense that she's reserve. There's specific language that's required, and the trial court did not consider any of that.
Well, do I understand it correctly from the record that both parties essentially agreed and retained Ms. Squires to draft these?
That is my understanding. However, I don't believe that's what actually transpired. That's part of the problem. There was a point in time when she was retained, but I'm not certain that the record reflects exactly what the extent of her retention was, whether in fact she did draft these. But aside from that, it's not correct on its face. She's a reservist. There's certain language that's required.
Is she a reservist now?
Yes.
Or was the...
No, the retired pay that was subject to the division was actually based upon her reservist retired pay.
Okay. So even if she's active duty now under the new position?
Correct. So it was only supposed to be the reservist portion, which is why she's having the issue with it, because it doesn't accurately reflect that formula. And that's, she doesn't really have much of an option. And the case law doesn't say that DFAS has to reject before she would have then the right to appeal up if the court didn't enter an order.
But we have nothing in the record, and perhaps we wouldn't because the case isn't over yet, that DFAS has said this won't do other than your interpretation of the regs and the formula's wrong on its
Correct.
Case.
That's and that's the issue. The DFAS has not said one way or the other because the case is still pending. But
wasn't there a representation that Ms., at least at one point from counsel, maybe not evidence, but the court inquired and counsel responded that Ms. Squires had been in contact with DFAS and everything was okay?
That was a representation. He said that they potentially, he paraphrased it, it was hedged, exactly. So that's part of the problem. And so Ms. Peterson, because it didn't reflect the proper verbiage as is required under the DFAS manual and everything else, that's why she made the appeal. The other issue about the indemnifying language, she raised the issue. It's as to protecting the retirement, because he's 100% disabled, he's got 100% disability.
When was it first raised?
It was raised at the time that the qualifying, the quadros were raised at that time. It was not raised at the trial. It was not raised in the final decree. I would submit that because the award was 45% of the marital share of the retirement, that the court can still grant, in order to protect that award, could still, under 2107.3 sub K, could still enter an order that provides for that.
Right, and with concepts of raising things timely with trial courts, in brief, you talk about how everybody was aware that this would be an issue because he's so profoundly disabled, mm-hmm. but doesn't that suggest it should have been raised at the beginning?
It does certainly suggest that, and it wasn't by trial counsel. But because she raised it, because Ms. Peterson raised it, albeit as a pro se, she did raise it on several occasions by way of motions to reconsider and the like.
The motion to reconsider that's filed 21 days on the 21st day, is there any evidence in the record that the trial court was even aware that the motion had been filed? The judge himself, because there's that case from the Virginia Supreme Court that says just filing the motion in the clerk's office
isn't bringing it to
the court's attention, and whether one agrees or disagrees with that, that's the law of Virginia.
That is correct. There is nothing in the record that suggests that.
So there's no, if I understand it, then this issue, there's no evidence that this issue was brought to the trial court's attention before the final decree became final, unless the suspending order didn't.
Exactly.
Okay.
There is none. Thank you.
So to follow up on that, when it was filed on the 21st day, was there any attempt, I think I heard your answer on that, but I just want to make sure, was there any attempt made to at least alert the trial court that it needed to be suspended pending ruling on that motion?
There is nothing in the record that supports that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Consistent with tradition, we'll come down and greet counsel.
All right.